This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Garrett Brown is here. He's the author of two books, and maybe more, we'll find out. And he's a professor at Anne Arundel Community College. And he has seen a lot of hopeful poets pass through his halls, so we want to hear about that. But first, his own poetry. And here's Garrett with a poem.
Thank you, Grace. Thanks for having me here. 19 lines to the Stone Age. Feel the thin space age thicken to balk relic, compact, discs to cassette, 8-track, captain, Kirk phones flip back into spiral, cords and clattering rotary, 64-bit pixie princesses pixelate to 8-bit blocks, slaying duck dragons with an arrow, the razor baton leading a WYSIWYG parade of text squares into a cursor's sly wink, as broken promises of paperless universes coalesce into recycled reams. The blackout rises a few feet each year, and sleep mode lights on laptops too will dim into bioluminescence, fireflies suspended over deer, skins drying by campfire while the ears of hunting dogs twitch.
Garrett, your consonants. I didn't know this about you. Are you famous for your consonants?
I'm pretty world famous for consonants, yes.
I'll tell you, you really know how to do that.
Well,
some people
you.
Show off their vowels, but you're much more pitch perfect. How do you describe your poetry? I mean, if you were to say, someone said, okay, here's Garrett Brown world, and you have to know who he is by what he says right now.
I think my poetry is wrestling with the emergence of information technology and how that's changing the way that we think about text and the way that we think about words.
And what more noble purpose could there be for poetry to challenge that? And so you demonstrate it by using technological terms and new age mm-hmm. images. But is that the way you always wrote? Technology?
Not initially. My early work was wrestled a lot with the notion of religion and loss of religion, but also still a real desire to hold on to things like community and family and culture.
So you started, like everybody, with the big things, pain, death, loss, cultural mm-hmm. consciousness. But I love the way you've homed in on the crisis that we're in with language and technology.
It's crisis, but I also think it's opportunity. You know, I think new technologies bring new words and new ways of thinking about things, and new metaphors.
And you're not fighting that. You're not mourning the loss.
I think there is nostalgia, I think, in a lot of these poems that you'll see, a nostalgia for that materiality of the world. That are all around us begin to fade away.
Right? Oh, so well said, really, because we are moving more toward a virtual reality. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're codifying it and making it permanent, then it's not going to go anywhere at all.
And I think that's what poetry and art has always tried to do, you know, to kind of preserve the world around us and our experiences.
Well, let's hear some. Garrett Brown at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And this is a new book. I think your first book, Cubicles?
This is my
second.
This is my second book. So this chapbook came out a few years after my first book, Mana Sifting. This is the concluding poem of this book. And it kind of addresses exactly what we were just talking about. So this is the idea of this book is it's sort of like a Spoon River anthology kind of thing, where each poem is a character name, and the title of the poem is the character's name, and then each character has a place in this office setting. They're all in cubicles, and so each character is, you know, responding to their situation, you know, differently in a unique way. And so this guy, David Lee, instead of having a cubicle number, he's in the mailroom and he's surrounded by, you know, sort of the tangibility of moving information and, you know, and thinks about that as sort of a vanishing space. So this is called David Lee, Mailroom. Black hair tied at the base of his neck, David was a double major, history and philosophy, wrote his last seminar paper about the 60s as the last truly pastoral civilization. He refers to computer icons as hieroglyphics, maintains a rainbow of colored post-it notes along his walls, pops bubble wrap when nervous. Aware of his anachronistic position, he imagines himself a lamplighter at the dawn of electricity, tipping a ladder up the post, oil can in hand, a pocket bulging with matches. He wants to gather the vanishing tangibility of the world, kerosene evaporating off knuckles, envelope glue intoxicating the tongue.
So this prophet winds up in the mailroom.
Yes.
Well, that's a lesson for all of us, I guess. Now, your poems, when I teach form, I say, just make it pretty on the page.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big thing. And you do make your poems pretty mm-hmm. on the page, especially this book, so that each page is aesthetically a work of art. Will you describe that?
Of course. So the concept behind the cubicle poems as a series is each one is sort of a 10-line block of text, and there is a caesura in the middle six lines.
Well, you'll have to tell people what that is.
So the caesura is just a break in the line. And so what the result is that you get a little kind of white space in the middle of each block. And so as you're going through the cubicles, each one is, you know, perfectly cubical in
a
shape.
A stanza.
Each stanza, right. Mm-hmm. But there's a unique kind of little footprint of, or a fingerprint of white space in between each one.
And what made you do that?
I really wanted to think about the ways in which, so I spent a lot of time working as an office temp. It's one of the ways that before becoming an academic and a teacher, I kind of made my way, you know, working in various offices. And I was always sort of an outsider kind of looking in. And one of the things, so I've worked in a lot of places where people work in cubicles, and it's always struck me the way that people try to personalize their cubicles and the way they hang things on the wall, or they bring tchotchkes in, or they, you know, they just do different things to make their space stand out. And I'm interested in that tension between kind of the system of capitalism or the workplace or whatever you want to call it, trying to standardize everyone, and the little bits of resistance sort of against that.
Oh, that is so excellent. So you demonstrate that on the page
mm-hmm, yeah.
with a little bit of
resistance. And hopefully in the poems as well.
Yes, not only the content, but the resistance mm-hmm. in form. Let's have more poetry, Garrett Brown. I'll tell everyone who you are. Your first book of poems was Mana Sifting, and then Cubicles we're hearing from. And you have won a very prestigious award from the Poetry Center of Chicago, and that was judged by Jury Graham, who's been on our program. And you've won creative writing fellowships from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Why did they honor a poet, Art Institute?
So I did my Master's of Fine Arts at the Art Institute in Chicago, and they are very committed to interdisciplinary work. So they have a writing program in an art school. You are encouraged to kind of explore other media while you're there. So I did a little bit of painting. I did a little bit of playwriting. You kind of are allowed to sort of dabble in a way that I really believe in. You know, I think that ability to, the arts all have something to offer each other. And, you know, you can learn from painting, you know, learning by like how a splash of red in a painting, like, you know, pulls the eye out or draws the eye to a particular place is similar to the way like a repeated consonant, you know, or a certain vowel sound might, you know, kind of keep the reader's ear in a certain place. And so, you know, there's things to be learned from all different kind of media.
But you won the prize, and that was a big thing. And we honor that.
No,
but
thank
we
you.
Do honor your poetry, so let us hear more. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and that's Garrett Brown.
So this is another poem from Cubicles. This is Holly Stone, who lives in cubicle 3845. After three cups of coffee, her platform shoes are clicking against the partition wall that she and Allison share. She pours two-thirds of a creamer in each cup, watches the white galaxy swirl. At 2 p.m., she drags herself down to the pop machine for her afternoon cherry Coke. She read on Wikipedia about a device in ancient Alexandria, a pan that caught coins and dispensed a trickle of holy water. For her, the sacred has always been doled out, like the machine at Skateland when she was a kid, a globe of plastic bubbles, winking with secret decoder rings, rubbery arachnids, and lick'em stick'em tattoos.
I am loving these characters. Let's have two more.
Sure. So this is Martin Cheevy. And so one of the things that I wanted to do as I was writing this was, you know, it occurred to me that I was, you know, mimicking Edgar Lee Masters and Robinson. And so I wanted to, and I always liked the poem Minerva Cheevy. And so I figured I would just put in a very direct reference. And so this is Martin Cheevy, which is kind of in some ways a modern rewrite of Minerva. Martin Cheevy, cubicle 3820. He spends the morning designing graphics for the quarterly report, annual expenditures versus streams of revenue, while on the shelf overhead sit Isaac Asimov, Frank Herbert, and an English to Klingon dictionary. At lunch, he grabs his bike, zooms over to Dark Tower Comics on Madison, where the owner invites him into the back to smoke a fatty and flip through vintage issues of Green Lantern in mint condition. Martin holds a hit, laments he never pursued, illustration or screenwriting, superheroes left abandoned in his head. Instead, he surrendered to salary, bonuses, a nameplate. Martin exhales, coughs, calls it fate. And the last one that I'll read from this is, so as I said before, I spent a lot of time working as an office temp.
Were you a good one?
I was a good office temp. The character in here who's the temp is not.
But you, as a poet, you respect filing, you respect stapling.
Well, what was really interesting, what was fantastic about being an office temp, especially in the late 90s, early aughts, was that for the most part, people left you alone. You were brought in, you were shown to your cubicle, and then you were forgotten about for at least a week. So I would spend a lot of time like writing and working on my poems. And eventually, and then another thing would happen, which is something that I try to tell my students all the time when I'm teaching writing, is that once somebody in the office figured out that I could write, then it was, well, can you review this memo? Can you edit this? Can you do this? Can you do that? And then it was time for me to move on to the next assignment.
And then you became the associate professor at a college.
Right.
So let's hear this one.
Sure. Temporary, 3850. I cringe at the balding guy training me, his hipster glasses, twill weave suit I could never afford. Every joke a reference to Homer, Simpson, or The Office. He explains to me that Modesto is a city in California, that I should cut that hippie hair if I want a real job. Dick. After an hour explaining the complexity of transferring calls, he finally leaves me alone, with the filing that takes all of 20 minutes. The rest of the afternoon, I purposely drop his calls, switch up numbers on his speed dial, use his password to download Young Up-and-Comers 3 to his hard drive, and enjoy a long smoke break.
Well, that was well worth your occupation, that book.
And that's definitely, the temporary is the only first-person poem in the book. I wanted that sort of outsider's perspective that, you know, if all of these characters are me to a certain extent, but, you know, and that one actually, ironically, is probably the least like me because I never, I had fantasies of that kind of revenge.
And you didn't want a twill suit. You never really wanted a twill suit.
No, not at all.
What do your students think when they read your poetry? I think it is a worry And I'm glad that I don't introduce my poetry at all when I teach, because you don't want them to imitate you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never assign any of my own poems.
Yeah.
I do share my process. And so I will share, like, for example, there's a poem that I sort of just purposely saved drafts at a certain stage. And so I kind of show them how a first draft that is a big blob of text on a page eventually gets, you know, whittled down and down and down until it's something
shiny and glossy. What do you want them to know about poetry?
I want to teach them
ultimately.
I want to teach them how to read. If I can teach them how to read a book of poetry, then I feel like I've given them the tools to. I've given them multiple teachers.
Oh, it is inimitable that every teacher of poetry teaches a different way. Mm-hmm. There are just no two approaches. But the idea that if they can read those line lengths, they can learn poetry.
And I find, you know, for many of my students, especially younger people, contemporary poetry is kind of impenetrable, you know? And so to be able to teach them how to take this nut and crack it and to figure out how you get
then will they learn more about writing it?
I would hope so.
Garrett Brown is here, and he's going to read us another poem. And where is this poem coming from?
So this is from my collection, Mana Sifting. And this is another obsession of mine is the sciences.
Mana, as in manna from heaven?
As in manna from heaven, yes. So this is a poem that is... It's about Percival Lowell observing Mars, and I should probably explain a little bit about Percival Lowell. Percival Lowell is sort of responsible for our idea of, like, little green men as being Martians. He was the one that looked at Mars in a telescope and thought he saw canals and hypothesized that there were civilizations on Mars and that the canals were built by the Martians to sort of bring water from the poles down to the more habitable parts of the equator. And so what I like about that idea, or what kind of made me want to write a poem about it, is this idea that we often see what we want to see, right? And so, you know, one of the interesting things about science, and I think one of the interesting things about poetry as well, right? Part of what poetry does is supposed to shatter the ways in which we use language so that we can see something fresh for the first time. And science kind of does a similar thing where the methodology is supposed to help you see what's really there, not, you know, what your brain is telling you should be there or what your biases are telling you should be there. And so this poem kind of is about sort of science getting it wrong or Lowell sort of letting his brain get in the way. Anyway, I'll read it. Opposition, August 27th, 2003. The epigraph is from Tony Rothman. It says, "Metaphor is the frayed thread that connects what we desire with what merely exists." Even before squinting through a telescope, Percival Lowell revealed what he was hoping to see, exquisite web of channels, evidence of a vast Venus etched into the rusty disk of Mars. Did he dream of green-skinned gondoliers smoothly rowing from pier to alien pier, soothing their linear canali with Martian song? Skeptical scientists knew Lowell was wrong. What we wish to see prevents us from seeing what is. Don't we all wish to draft perfect lines, envision a complete cathedral, instead of quarrying the awkward facts, imperfect stones resisting the symmetry of the church wall? Tonight, closer than it will ever be, I watch the planet from my window and shed Lowell's imagined world for the frayed thread of metaphor. Iron rusting on the surface, the same element that warms the pigment in our veins, Mars, a speck of blood in the cold, impenetrable night.
That is so mellifluous to be of such a hard subject. Let's have two more poems from you because we're really hearing your voice.
Oh, great. So this poem is from a series of poems about paleontology. It sort of came, my second manuscript sort of emerged out of some of the themes that I, from the poem I just read, scientists kind of getting it wrong. And I was really interested in the ways in which early paleontologists were just rich guys that could afford to take a train out west and dig in the dirt for a summer. And the so it got me kind of involved in this sort of in like late 19th century conceptions of the prehistoric. And so this poem, it's called Dinosaurs in Central Park. And it Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins, who was sort of a sculptor and was famous for doing these statues of dinosaurs at the Crystal Palace in London, which I think most people have probably seen pictures of but don't realize that that's what it was. He was commissioned to do a similar thing in New York, and the project got destroyed. And it's kind of debatable whether it was for financial reasons or whether there was some religious objections there to
creationism,
right? Exactly. And so the but I'm interested in the fact that these statues of dinosaurs are kind of destroyed and erased, sort of the way that the original dinosaurs are. So anyway, the poem will probably say it better than that. Dinosaurs in Central Park. From iron, from clay, Waterhouse Hawkins assembled the prehistoric diorama for London's Crystal Palace. Muscular iguanodons, Megalosaurus shouldered like a lioness, crocodilian snout. Queen Victoria herself blessed this colossal menagerie. In New York, Hawkins is commissioned to forge a similar tableau for Central Park. Hadrosaurus molded into a reclining sphinx. Kangaroo-like lilaps sparring over a fresh kill. He animates the excavated bones scraped from the sides of mesas, raised like trophies from the canyons and dried seabeds known as the West, a proud display of America's terrible lizards to rival the British. But more terrifying than teeth or sweeping tails as thick as cedar trees is extinction. That the Almighty would allow a species to perish, creation to unhook, link by link. And so Tammany Hall shuts the project down, hires thugs to break into Hawkins' workshop and erase the blasphemy. They sledgehammer concrete legs and smash skulls, wrench apart iron frames and bury the remains, new fossils never to be found, lurking still under the carousel, clawing behind the tunnels of the 8th Avenue subway.
You said it all there, didn't you? Yes. And before we have a final poem, I do want to know, as a child, when was it that you first realized that you understood the world through language, that this was the paradigm, this was the way to understand the chaos? Those hieroglyphics, mm-hmm. language. Can you remember? I can remember that moment. Can you remember when language meant so much to you?
I remember. There's a couple of phases to this, I think. In middle school, I had a teacher who, I was always very interested in writing stories. I was interested in plot and fantasy stories and things like that. I had a teacher that kind of said, like, you're a poet, you need to be writing poetry. And she would, you know, try to encourage me and gave me books of poetry. I didn't want anything of it at the time. I was very resistant to it. Somewhere along, it was probably early to mid high school when I finally kind of began to fall in love with the language of poetry. And part of it was Shakespeare's sonnets. A lot of it was romanticism and, you know, learning about, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Shelley. I mean, those are my, and Keats especially, that was my way into the world of poetry.
Well, we'll have a final poem.
This poem has a lot of references that might need to be identified. So part of what this poem is, this poem is called Glitch, and it's about computer glitches, but it's also about narrative glitches. And so I grew up on video games. I'm really interested in the way that, you know, video games that used to be more like arcade or pinball or sports based are now more narrative based. You know, you have games where the story is supposed to be very important. And there's this tension between the player, you know, playing a game and having sort of freedom to do things and the necessity of the story that's being laid out by the writer of the game, right? So there's this tension there. And you can do things like, a classic example is you're playing a game, someone gives you a quest, you know, go into those mountains and fetch that axe for me. And you come back with the axe, and while you were gone, like, someone else came through and killed that character, and now you can't complete the quest, right? So that's a glitch in the game. So I'm interested in that. I make a reference to data bending, which is this form of art that kind of came out of an arts movement in Chicago in like the 70s, where people would take, digital images, and basically they go into the code, just kind of, you know, they're not coders, they don't know what they're doing. They just sort of mess a bunch of stuff up and then kind of reload it. And so you wind up with like images that are, you know, skewed or weird in some sort of way. And so again, it's sort of in this issue of kind of randomness intruding upon something that should be very linear and clockwork-like. And there's also sort of a reference to a moth, which is of course like the first computer bug was actually a bug, right? It was a moth that got into the machine. So this is called Glitch. Narrative comes unstitched. I return to find the quest giver dead. Plot to knots instead of a twist. Back to the load screen to sift past saves and recover the thread before narrative comes unstitched. Cybermoshers knows the rift between image and code. Bend data to bits, the original twist. Was an ordinary moth caught adrift, coiled in wires, wings spread, among circuits looped and stitched. Inside gears and tape it slipped, cursorial legs treading punched manila stock, and twists, language, and mutations in persist, metamorphic viruses shred, artifice stitched, un-404, syntax error, fail whale, no carrier. Again? Son of a bitch. It's also a villanelle. Which I had never wrote a successful villanelle before. So
that is the voice of Garrett Brown, and we won't forget it. This is The Poet of the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.